The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He's the author of The Good Soldier on Trial, a sociological study of misconduct by the U.S. military pertaining to Operation Triangle that was in Iraq. These things never go away. We want to talk about a man who was involved in that defending U.S. soldiers in Operation Iron Triangle. We've talked about him before. We talked about the fact that Paul Berggren is the man. We talked about the fact that he was unjustly charged with multiple offenses he didn't commit. The charges got reworked over a number of months or so, and they ended up, I believe, about 33 charges. I mean, just preposterous. I mean the charges, I've got them all in one of three articles that I wrote, my latest. It made him sound worse than Osama, if Osama really were as bad as we say he was anyway. I mean, it would make Paul Berggren top the FBI's most wanted list if they didn't have him in custody. Anyway, he went on trial. The jury, as far as I know, Stepan will update me because I'm not up to date as of the moment, but the court proceedings were completed. The jury was deliberating. A co-attorney, Berggren is representing himself with a co-attorney as well with him, appointed by the court. And according to the other gentleman, the case was a slam dunk decision for the jury, but they were deliberating for maybe 5 days now. Stepan, I welcome you. Bring me up to date on Paul. What is the latest? Are they still deliberating?
Yes, this is their fourth day of deliberation. I follow the trial daily, even though it's disappointing that it's become a local news story. In other words, it's tracked mainly by the New Jersey Ledger. That's the name of the newspaper. The national media has ignored the story. Like you said, Paul has absolutely demolished the government's case. He's found outright lies, inconsistencies, all kinds of holes in the statements of the witnesses, and he's demonstrated that the witnesses are motivated by promises that the government has made to those convicted felons that they've lined up against him for a reduced sentence if they would say the things the government wants them to say against Paul. So anyone who's followed this on a daily basis, the score is basically Paul Berggren 10, government 0. It is somewhat surprising to a lot of people that the jury deliberations are now entering the fourth day. I wish we could have this conversation and be able to say that they found him not guilty, but right now that's not the case. They're still deliberating.
Well, I'll say this, Stepan, when the verdict is in, whatever it is, and we both have our fingers crossed, it certainly will be mentioned on this program. And if there's more information that needs to be provided, I absolutely will do it. I haven't communicated with Paul lately, but I established contact with him through the prison system core links, and they don't make it easy for people to go back and forth, and they certainly don't make it easy to send any information. I'd be delighted if Paul could read my articles, and whether he's been able to get them. I can't email them. They wouldn't give them to him, and I think there's a limit on how much I can put in an email anyway, and an article way exceeds the content limit of an email. But anyway, they have treated him very, very, very roughly, in a New York City jail. They've kept him in solitary confinement a lot of the time. I mean, they've treated him like he really is, like he really is a dangerous person, a wild animal that you have to lock up and keep away from other human beings. And Paul is a very distinguished, capable lawyer. No surprise in the world, Stepan, that he would walk into a courtroom with any other adversary and rip him to pieces as long as the facts supported him. He was that good. He is that good.
Right. And just to fill in for your listeners what you're saying, in distinguished record indeed. He was a former prosecutor at the very office in New Jersey, the federal prosecutor's office that is now prosecuting him. He was in that office. And the reason he apparently upset them was that he refused to prosecute some people he thought was unfair to prosecute, and he sees this as revenge, you know, by that prosecutor's office, which is, you know, I mean, this is a really historically interesting case. Somebody who was a prosecutor, was in the Army, then became a distinguished defense lawyer. Among his clients, the newspapers usually list rappers, but it's very important, as you pointed out, that he defended Corey Claggett, who was a U.S. soldier, in the Operation Iron Triangle case, which involved an unlawful order by the brigade commander to kill all military-age males on site. And he was going to achieve something very incredible in that case, and that is he got permission from the judge to have the colonel in charge testify about that order. But the trial never occurred. And he was arrested a week before that trial began. And that soldier took a plea bargain as a result. And he also defended Jamal Davis in the Abu Ghraib cases. And again, I think it's important for your listeners to know that the so-called seven rotten apples, or the accused soldiers in that case, have by now been convincingly portrayed as scapegoats for a much wider policy of torture memos that came straight from the White House. So he's been involved in some very important cases. Definitely the word distinguished fits him. The other part I want to fill in is, even now during this trial, when the trial is over on a given day, they still put him in solitary confinement at night. So even as he's defending himself, he doesn't have the normal access to information, to his lawyer, and to the normal ways that we would expect you know, someone to be able to defend themselves when they're fighting for their life. It's just incredible what's going on here, and it's not being covered by the national media.
It's shocking, Stepan, and tragic, and absolutely appalling. Number one, that this goes on in the first place, and the fact that the major media, they don't stand up for justice. They stand up for whatever the state authorities or corporate officials want. It is so rare when they take a stand, when they do the right thing instead of the wrong thing. And writing about politically persecuted people, Stepan, is one of my core issues. I do it all the time. And I decided this morning, I managed to draft an article. I'm not sure I'm done yet, but I managed to draft an article on the breaking news over the weekend that another Muslim, a Central American who converted to Islam, was charged with wanting to bomb New York sites. Well, my goodness, I've been through this several times before. The other people charged were absolutely innocent. There was no evidence whatever to prove they wanted to do anything. And in all of these cases, well, I wrote about this fellow, Jose Pimentel, and I'm still working on the article, but they come up with these charges, Stepan, and they always either entrap somebody in an elaborate sting. I was looking for something that would give me more clarity on that, but I did find that they used, which probably again is for a sting, they use what they call a paid informant. A paid informant, I have to translate the language, Stepan, a paid informant almost always is a convicted felon or somebody charged with offenses, and in return for that person's cooperation, they will get leniency, and they also will be extremely well paid. It can run, depending on how long they work for the government, it can run into six figures, I believe possibly tax-free. Well, I'm not certain about that. I'll take that statement back. But it can run into six figures because this stuff has come out officially. I mean, it's astonishing. Maybe somebody, and they stayed on this Pimentel fellow for over 2 years. So we're talking about a sizable hunk of cash to get this guy locked up. And whether or not he did anything, who knows?
Right.
There's a lot of commotion going on in New York right now, Stephen. I just wonder whether this was a New York charge. This was not a federal charge. This was the New York Police Commissioner and Mayor Bloomberg and the Manhattan District Attorney. Maybe they want to distract attention from what's going on in the city.
Well, I don't know enough about that case, but what you said about the paid informants applies to Paul's case. What that case is about is, you know, the headlines read he's charged with murder. It makes it sound like he strangled somebody with his bare hands. In fact, it's a charge of conspiracy that involves a government informant who was killed by some gang members in New Jersey. And what the government is saying is that because some of Paul's former clients were apparently involved, it's not clear they were involved in the killing of the government informant, that therefore Paul Berggren was involved in that conspiracy. Now, it's a convoluted argument because, number one, a lawyer is going to have for his or her clients those kinds of people that commit murder. That's by definition being a lawyer. Number two, this paid informant, you know, fits the bill of what you just said. But in addition, the government refused to protect him. He asked for a witness protection program. He did not get it. The gangs in New Jersey found out that this person, his name is Chemo, was an informant, and somebody had him killed. But instead of the government owning up to its own incompetence in this case, they've made the government informant, who is, by the way, a black man, a scapegoat, and they're trying to now pin that killing of the informant on Paul Berggren. So, like you said, these are incredibly orchestrated, convoluted, artificial sorts of scenarios that the government dreams up instead of what we would normally think about as crimes. And I think that's an important part to think about.
Oh, absolutely, Stephen. I've said it many times in this program. I have written literally on many dozens of people falsely charged. Terrorism-related cases, not murder or drug trafficking so much, but terrorism-related cases, most of them targeting Muslims, some targeting people like the Black Panthers. I reviewed an older case that got back into the news because because the story was revived. The story never ended, and it was revived, and I wrote about that. I've written about Latinos that have been targeted. I've written about environmental and animal rights activists who have been targeted. None of these people committed any crimes, or certainly nothing worth charging anybody with and putting them away. And the cases are all manipulated and rigged, and the juries are literally scared within an inch of their lives. They whip up hysteria in the courtroom using all kinds of convoluted stuff that they bring up. A lot of it is irrelevant, and a decent judge would throw the stuff out, Stephen, but they don't. They don't. And if there's an Israeli connection, they can bring in an Israeli witness, maybe keep the person secret. Whatever that person's testimony is totally unrelated to the case. That's what happened with Lynn Stewart, and it's been a while since I last wrote about her. I wrote about her multiple times. She's in prison for 10 years for doing her job. She's the same situation as Paul Berggren. They went after her because she did her job, and she defended people that the government did not want to get a defense, and that made her a criminal in their eyes, so they stuck her away for 10 years. They want to put Paul away. And one more thing, Stephen, if Paul is totally exonerated, it doesn't by any means mean he is off scot-free.
Exactly.
They can just come back and they can come up with new charges. I wrote about one case, people charged down in Miami with, among other things, wanting to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. They probably had never been to Chicago or knew what the Sears Tower was. Maybe they never even knew about the Sears Tower. But twice, a jury either deadlocked or let them off, and they were recharged, new charges, and on the third try, they were convicted. I'm absolutely convinced they're innocent. They did absolutely nothing. So these people, I don't know how many years they got, but they're put away. Sammy Alarion, I've written about. Sammy Alarion was exonerated by a jury. They were hung on a few lesser charges. His attorney actually struck a plea bargain with the government. The government, this was during the Bush years, the government welched on the plea bargain, and his case is still ongoing, and he's out. They wouldn't let him out. He finally got out, but he could end up being put back in prison. He's a completely innocent man. That's the kind of system of justice we have, Stephen. You know it. I sure know it.
Yeah, I think... From what I've seen in my work as an expert witness, the government has just way too much power than maybe even 50 years ago or even what anything remotely what the founding fathers intended. Two new developments in the past few decades I think I would point out to. One is the use of the plea bargain as a way to so-called streamline the process, because what the government does is it offers incredible threats to the person they want to testify against someone else at the same time that they seem to offer them a bargain or a deal. So a lot of innocent people, or at least innocent for the exact charges they're being charged with, will plead guilty in order to, of course, save themselves. And this is being used in about 95% of the cases now. It's way overused beyond what its intended meaning might have been. And the second one is the definition of the word conspiracy, which has now been so broadened that if you just know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who might have been accused with a crime, in a convoluted sort of way, they can and do oftentimes charge you with conspiracy. So I've seen this in every single one of the cases I've been on involving U.S. soldiers. The conspiracy charge, I mean, just to give you an example, in the Abu Ghraib case, there was a soldier named Jeremy Civitz. What he actually physically did, he took one photograph, not two or five or 100, one. And from that one act of taking one photograph, he was a mechanic at Abu Ghraib. He was charged with conspiracy for maltreatment and all the other things that went on at Abu Ghraib. He pleaded guilty in order to avoid a harsh sentence, and he testified against the others. But he went to prison basically for taking one photograph. He never tortured anybody. He never hit anybody. He never called anyone a name. He was basically a nice guy, the mechanic, who just happened to be there. Someone handed him a camera and said, here, take one photo. He did. So, you know, it's absolutely preposterous when you dig a little deeper and get into some of these cases what seems to be going on.
Well, there's no question about it. And my definition of conspiracy, Stepan, is that when they have absolutely no evidence whatever and they can't accuse somebody of wanting to bomb a building or shoot somebody or whatever, they charge them with conspiracy.
Right.
They're just assuming that this person in some way was involved in whatever the charge is. So the charge, I mean, they always include conspiracy charges, but sometimes
but the
only charges are conspiracy charges, nothing more direct
right.
than that. And to me, that is clear evidence that they have nothing on this person. This is the only way they can issue a charge, so they do it in this convoluted, meaningless way, but they can put somebody
right.
away for a lot of years by doing it.
Right. I'm not sure your listeners know, because I was surprised when I came across this. You know, when we think of conspiracy, if you look it up in a dictionary, it means to plot, to talk with other people, to have a secret plan, to have secret meanings and meetings. And that's not the legal definition. By legal definition, the government does not have to prove that you intended something, that you contacted anyone, that you had a plan. The definition reads, that by your actions one may infer that you were of a like mind as someone else. I mean, when you look at it, it's absolutely Orwellian. You know, how is the government to be able to prove what's going on in your mind when they are not required to have any objective proof that you talked to somebody, met with somebody, actually said something, or actually committed certain acts? None of those things are required. So this new definition of conspiracy has entered into the law in the 1980s as a way to go after drug traffickers and racketeers, and is now being used indiscriminately across the board. It's something that the legal profession does not seem to have, taken seriously for its negative social consequences. I mean, I don't know why lawyers are not standing up to this, because it absolutely defies common sense, academic reasoning, philosophy, you name it. I mean, it would never stand up in any university class in the United States or the world to say that you conspired by just simply existing next to somebody who was next to somebody who might have done something. I mean, it's absolutely preposterous, and yet that is the definition, and that's why a lot of innocent people get convicted because of this definition and its misuse.
And the hypocrisy too, Stepan, is so extreme.
Right.
We get high level people committing the most grievous crimes, whether we're talking about war crimes or grand theft by the crooks on Wall Street. They don't mess around with pocket change. They steal multi-millions, billions, trillions. What do they get? My God, steal a trillion, get a $100 million fine. Steal another
right.
trillion, get another. It's another $100 million fine, if they even get fined anything. And this goes on repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly. And belatedly, I decided to write something. I drafted an article yesterday, is not out yet, on the MF Global situation, where the former head of Goldman Sachs, John Corzine, was involved in looting his customers' accounts, looting their accounts of billions of dollars to speculate, to cover his debt obligations, to cover other whatever he wanted to do with the money, looted them. Now, this case is still ongoing. I simply can't imagine that this guy is going to be wearing a numbered striped suit. But, I mean, he is a criminal. He was a criminal at Goldman Sachs. He's a criminal. He was a criminal as a U.S. senator and as the governor of New Jersey. And then he got into private business, and he's a criminal. I mean, it's right out there in the open. Anybody can look at this thing and see. There's a lot of public information already to show that this guy literally stole money from his customers' accounts. And, I mean, it's shocking, and we'll see how this thing ends up. It could take years. I mean, this guy is so rich. When he left Goldman Sachs, by the way, a different situation altogether, but when he left Goldman Sachs a dozen years ago, he was worth a reported $400 million. So you'll get 12 years to go by, and all the extra money making I'm sure he made, he could be worth over $1 billion now. So he can buy all the legal help he needs. He could drag out the case for the rest of his life, never spend a day behind bars, maybe end up paying a few bucks in fines or whatever the heck they do. Maybe a few lower-level people in the company will be thrown to the wolves. That's the way the system works. But when the government goes after people like Paul or Muslims that they want to get for political advantage, they get into a courtroom, and the whole system there is rigged to convict. The judges are part of the corrupted system. There is no justice at all when these people walk into a courtroom, Stephen. I mean, they're not. Once they're charged, once they're indicted, and they always finish the indictment on the bottom saying, I don't have the language in front of me, and I don't see a federal indictment, but I'm sure the state is just about the same. Well, they say, these are only charges. The person is innocent until
right.
proved guilty. The hell
right.
they are. They're guilty unless by some manner of means they can be proved innocent. So the system
right.
is totally turned on its head. What kind of a system is this? In a country calling itself a democracy, there's no democracy here, Stepan. We both know that.
Right. I just want to make a connection to what you said about John Corzine and what Paul was doing. Paul was very much the champion of the underdog, and I think one of the things that got him noticed on the government radar was that in the Abu Ghraib cases, he wanted Donald Rumsfeld to testify at the trials of some of the Abu Ghraib soldiers. So you have low-ranking soldiers, people on the very bottom, who went to Leavenworth, whereas the people who drafted the torture memos, the lawyers, and all those people in between the White House and the soldiers in Iraq, as you know, some of them, like John Yoo, are now professors at the University of California at Berkeley. And Rumsfeld is doing just fine. So, you know, he was very much trying to improve the situation that you're talking about. I mean, Paul was standing up for the little guy, for justice. Well, you just don't do that without a pushback from the government. And similarly, in the Operation Iron Triangle cases, he wasn't satisfied to just put up a defense for his accused. He wanted to bring in a brigade commander. And beyond him, higher up, you know, who were the people who drafted these unlawful rules of engagement, which basically amount to a kind of assassination? You know, the rules of engagement were to just kill anybody on sight. So he took on some, Paul took on some really, he took on the big guys, and they pushed back. So there are parallels and connections between what you're saying and what I'm saying, in that I think, you know, I'm a sociologist. It seems that we're living in a time where the people on top, the 1%, when it comes to the law, they are very much protected, and the bottom 99% are extremely vulnerable.
Boy, they're not only vulnerable, Stepan. I mean, again, if you're charged, it's like getting trapped by a wild beast and there's no place to run. They have you in their jaws and you're not going to get away. You're going to be eaten alive. And, that's the system that we have. And, indeed, Paul really was courageous. He wanted to go right up the chain of command and get the people really responsible for the crimes that have been committed. And there's no doubt the crimes were committed. Anybody can read the law, U.S. law, international law, and know that what we did in every single war America fights, all the wars are lawless. They're illegal acts of aggression. Any law, any treaty that America signs is automatically U.S. law. The Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. So all of these treaties, and they're right there in black and white and simple English. Anybody can read them and understand them, and they can point fingers and know these people are guilty. All of these top officials and their underlings, they're all guilty of crimes of war and against humanity. And there's no ambiguity about it. But they can simply go back and do it again if they want to get back into government. Rumsfeld had a couple of rounds. He was there with, I think Gerald Ford, he was, I don't know if there was anybody else between Ford and George Bush Jr., but, I mean, talk about a criminal. He's one of the worst, but so many of them are that way, and they literally get away with murder, and this is the kind of system we have, and at the same time, they'll throw innocent people to the wolves and they'll charge. Every time I see a soldier charge, you'll see the headlines step on these people. I don't dig into the details to see what they're involved in, but they charge a soldier with murder or maybe rape or something or other. There was a recent one in the news and I don't know the person's name, and they'll hang them out to dry. They'll convict them. Well, maybe they did commit a crime. Who knows? But they followed orders. They followed orders.
Or policies, either one. That's right. Unlawful orders.
Oh, exactly. One more thing. The Army Field Manual, and I believe the other branches of service have a similar manual, where they say specifically, it is unlawful to follow a lawless order. And if you're given an order that violates the law, and I think they use language like, it's your duty to disobey it. Well, just try it. Just try disobeying an order and see what happens to you. So these low-level soldiers, literally, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
Right, and Paul was their champion. I mean, that's what I am trying to stress, that he stood out among the other lawyers who were defending these soldiers in that he was really going after the people on top. He was looking at the big picture. He was extremely forceful in the courtroom, and I think that's among the several factors. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, the revenge factor, I think, from the prosecutorial team in New Jersey, but also the fact that he was making waves, and you know, and this is his payback. So I'm hoping the jury will acquit him, and at least that will be that would be a miracle, given all that we've just said today, that a person could have stood up to these wolves and perhaps won.
Well, whatever's going to happen after this, Tip, and I hope that somehow he is acquitted, even if new charges are filed. I mean, he knows he's innocent, and needs to know that maybe some jurors, in spite of tremendous pressure, will stand by him. And I'm like you, I'm hanging breathless waiting to find out. Let's take a brief break, and then we'll come back and we'll continue this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking with Stepan Mestrovic, and we're talking about the case of Paul Berggren and all the things that relate to it. One comment, Stepan, I'll let you get back to Paul's case and other things related to it that are on your mind. The Lynn Stewart case is very similar to Paul's, where there's one wrinkle with Lynn's case that adds a level of outrage to it. Lynn spent her life as a human rights lawyer, taking on all the unpopular clients. And if I can remember a line I used once or twice in articles written about her, I said that she defended people others didn't want to touch, and they never would have had their day in court properly if they didn't have an advocate like her, because most people wouldn't touch them. But she was asked by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark to join his defense team to defend a blind sheikh accused of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center that I guess was sort of like a firecracker that didn't do all that much damage. Certainly didn't bring a building down, and certainly he did nothing to harm the building at all. But he was charged with it, and he was innocent. He had nothing to do with it. He also had been brought to this country. I think the CIA was involved, where they used him as one of their assets, and then they turned on him, which is typical U.S. government tactic. They use you, and then they throw you in the trash. And even if he was guilty, he deserved due process. Well, the government didn't want to give him due process. They wanted him to put away for life. I believe he was convicted, and this was the appeals case that was going on, if I remember. It's been a good while since I wrote about it. And Lynn was so busy she didn't want to join Ramsey's team, but one of the comments she made was, how do you say no to Ramsey Clark? So she joined the team.
Right.
I think that was her exact quote. She joined the team, and they were upset, plus all the other things that Lynn had done over the years defending unpopular clients, and they decided to go after her, and they did, and they jerry-rigged a case against her, and the first decision in court was the jury found her guilty, but the judge was so upset that this happened, that he used language you wouldn't see a judge make in a courtroom, or very rarely would you see that. And he ended up, the Bush Justice Department wanted to give Lynn 30 years. He gave her 16 months. And then it got brought back in on appeal, and an appeals court ended up giving her 10 years, to make a long story short. She's been there. She's been in prison a year now, this month. And she was, she was out on bail before that. But she's been in prison 1 year to date, 9 more years to go. Chances of her getting out, shorter sentence, leniency, parole, whatever. She's 71 years old, if I remember her age accurately. She could stay into 80.
Right.
She could end up dying in prison because she's not in the best of health. And she's a hero. She's a hero. She's
right.
Internationally renowned, and she could end up dying in prison.
Right, and as I recall from that case, what they got her on was a technicality, basically, something about passing information to her client.
Oh, absolutely.
Or is that expected to do? You know, you would expect from such a sentence that she would have done something heinous, but it again involved a artificial technicality.
And not only that, she did exactly the same thing that Ramsey Clark did. Of course, nobody charged him, but they charged Lynn.
Right. No, I mean, I think the very fact that we have lawyers in prison in America, I mean, should make the average person think twice and scratch their heads. I mean, there's something wrong with that scenario. And then when you look at, in the case of Lynn and Paul, distinguished lawyers who have made their careers out of defending the little guy, the people that most people would pass over. I mean, that shows commitment to principles and courage and all kinds of virtues. That we have those kinds of people in prison is very disturbing.
Boy, is it ever. It ever. I mean, talk about a police state, and I've written articles calling America what it is, a police state, and it's so easy to make the charge and make it stick, Stepan, because all you have to do is go back and look at the laws, mostly since 9/11, but you could find some before that. The Clinton administration had one beauty, 1996 law, I believe, an anti-terrorism bill. It's got a much longer name than that, but they put a lot of stuff in that law where they can basically go after everybody. But after 9/11, it was Katie by the door, starting with the horrendous USA Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, and one thing after another, plus a lot of so-called presidential and national security, two different types, presidential one, national security two, directives, presidential national security directives, homeland security directives, stipulating all kinds of stuff they can lop on people, and executive orders. Executive orders, and there was one military order that came out within weeks of 9/11 that basically said that authorities, the military, civilian authorities, could arrest anybody in the world and charge them with terrorism or the conspiracy to commit it, the all-purpose catch-all, and put them in a prison and hold them there. And now Obama has declared that anybody can be arrested anywhere in the world, including U.S. citizens, held indefinitely without charge, forever. Forever.
Wow.
This is Obama. This is not George Bush. This is Obama. And there's something new percolating in the Congress right now that takes what he did. In 2009, he did this, and I've got a draft of an article on that I haven't gotten out. Ratcheting up the indefinite detention business even more severely than it is already. So, I mean, talk about a police state, Stepan. It just gets worse and worse and worse. And in my mind, I say, if they decide they don't like what I'm doing, they know where I am. They sure know what I'm doing. They can come get me anytime and stick me away indefinitely and throw the key away, and there's not a darn thing I can do about it. And I certainly haven't broken any laws.
Yeah, well, that's kind of disturbing. I don't want to dwell on that. But I do want to make, as a sociologist, a connection to what else is going on in our society around the same time now, and that's the Occupy Wall Street movement. I mean, their theme is that, you know, they are the 99%, we are the 99%, and they're focusing, in fact, that the top 1% economically reaps all the benefits unfairly, unjustly, while the rest of us have to foot the bill for what happened on Wall Street and the debacle. But if you extend that connection just a little bit more to our discussion this morning about the law, you know, it's very similar. You've got basically the law that's sort of hand-tailored to the top 1%, whereas the bottom 99% law is being imposed upon them that's out of step, out of whack with the U.S. Constitution, which, as originally written, was meant to defend the little guy against the overwhelming power of the government. But, you know, no one's making that connection, number one, between the economic injustices and the legal injustices, and two, when you look at how the media approaches any of these topics, because the media are, of course, mostly owned by corporations, very negative slant in coverage of the Occupy Wall Street movement. You really can't get any sort of fair, unbiased coverage of it. And in a case like Paul, I don't know how it was with Lynn Stewart, but to me it's just really shocking that in a case like Paul, his trial is not on television. It's not followed by Fox News or by CNN or any of the big networks. It's a local New Jersey story. So, again, it shows that the top 1% is not just economic, but it also extends to legal and other dimensions of our society.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, this should be a major story. And being in New Jersey is like being in New York. You would think if the New York Times ran a reputable operation, they'd be covering this case. It's
exactly.
No small matter. I mean, and they run feature stories. They ran two stories today on this guy Pimentel, who's whoever heard of him before the story broke over the weekend. They ran two stories in the paper this morning. They probably never ran one about Paul, and Paul's case has been around for ages now. And they'll probably just ignore it altogether unless he's convicted, and then they might highlight a story, convicted murderer, drug trafficker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, convicted.
Right.
They might run that.
Right. No, it's very shocking. I mean, it's almost like the country's been hijacked by the top 1%.
Oh, boy, I sure believe it has been hijacked by the top 1%, and to talk about Occupy Wall Street, Stepan. I've written a good bit about it myself, and I've lost count of how many articles. I'm guessing maybe about 7 or 8 of them, and I'm sure I'm not done. I don't just want to recount the police violence from day to day or city to city, but I can't avoid not putting it into articles that I write. But I prefer to focus on a specific issue related to Occupy Wall Street and then bring other information into the article. And police violence certainly is one of the issues. Pretty ugly stuff. And in the face of it, these people are very brave. They just keep coming back. And the only thing I can say about them is they're lucky they don't live in Egypt and or Bahrain or Yemen, places like that where the police don't just beat up on people. The military goes out in the street and shoots them. It hasn't come to that here in this country, but it sure could. There've been at least two. I think there's been one person who died. I don't know the details about it. I don't think the police have shot anybody. I think there've been some instances of using rubber bullets, and I fail to understand how a rubber bullet might not at times be lethal. Still a bullet,
right?
And I guess it's fired at the same velocity. And the fact that it's got rubber around it, I mean, if you hit the right spot, I would think that somebody could be killed. I mean, if you got hit in the right spot on the temple, say, I mean, they could render somebody brain dead. That's like getting a powerful blow to the skull. And they use this kind of stuff. Plus the other stuff. I mean, mace and pepper spray and tear gas.
Right.
And beatings. I mean, the cops have billy clubs and they'll crack people with them so they can cause injuries. And then they lock them up in jail, treat them very roughly. They just stop short of drawing their weapons and opening fire and shooting people dead in the street. And this stuff does happen in these other countries. I think in Egypt, 3 or 4 days of protests. I did write about Egypt that I put out this morning. And early this morning I heard 20 people so far have been killed. But God knows how many injured and all the rest of it. Anyway, I mean, it's horrible. And these are the governments we support, Stepan. We support these people. In the case of Egypt, we give them over $1 billion, sometimes as much as $2 billion a year. And we say nothing. We rail about the so-called crimes that Syria and Gaddafi did. And we say nothing about what the Yemeni people, the Yemeni government is doing, the Bahraini government is doing. Not a word. Not a word. And when the mainstream media cover this stuff, they give a short shrift. They don't really do justice to it. They'll have a story once in a while, but this is a daily story. I mean, literally, people protesting every single day nonstop, week after week, month after month, and once in a while there's a story that falls way short of what the story should cover. What can I say?
Well, the irony here, Stephen, is that the Occupy Wall Street movement was inspired by the Arab Spring. I mean, they took that as their rallying point. You know, the irony being that Arab Spring was portrayed as imitating the old ideals of the United States, and in the United States we were following the Arab Spring as inspiration. As for what you said about the military has not yet been used, well, they don't have to be, because the police departments in the United States are trained in military-like tactics. I mean, when those when that incident occurred about the Iraqi War veteran in one of the protests, who sustained a terrific injury to his head from one of the tear gas canisters, he got a concussion.
Scott Olson.
I mean, what they do is, they get up at pre-dawn. They have similar kinds of formations, similar kinds of tactics. So, you know, it's I think it's a moot point that they haven't drawn out the military yet, because the police are using military tactics and they've got military weapons, including helicopters overhead. So, you know, I think that's just it's already being militarized, just in a disguised sort of way.
Oh, that's absolutely right, and it's been an awful long time, but post 9/11, federal dollars have been used to militarize militaries around the country, and at the same time, the old laws, early 19th century law forbidding U.S. military forces on streets, that was annulled in 2006. Also, along with that, I think it was the Insurrection Act around 1803 or something or other, and I remember that. I call the day that law was signed a day of infamy. That was, I believe it was October 17th, 2006. It's rare that I would remember a date like that. But on the same date, the Military Commissions Act was passed, and that got public fanfare. But annulling the 1803, I'll call it, maybe it was 1807, Insurrection Act, that maybe got, I don't think it got any coverage, because it was buried, in a defense authorization bill. So they snuck this new law onto the books by burying it in a defense authorization bill, and henceforth it allows U.S. military forces to go out on U.S. streets. And of course, in 2003, I think it was, the Pentagon established a U.S. command, NORTHCOM, for North America. What do they need to defend North America for? I don't see any invaders coming in. I don't see anybody on the shores of New York or Boston coming up Lake Michigan about to knock on my door. I don't see any of that happening. But we have NORTHCOM, so the military can be there. And sometimes, Stepan, the military actually goes out and they stay in the background. They're not visible, but they're right there, ready to come out and be used openly in case they're needed. But in the meantime, they're just behind the scenes. They bring them in on trains or other means of transportation, and this is what we have. The military can attack us. The militarized police can attack us. And, of course, we've got all the security forces, CIA, the rest of them, FBI. America for sure is not a safe place. One of my taglines is to say, America is no longer a safe place to live in. I sure don't feel it's a safe place to live in. Whether they're going to come and get me someday, I don't know, Stepan. But it's a thought that lurks in the back of my mind. And at my age, I say, they know who I am. They know what I do. They know where they can find me. If they want to come, they can come. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm not going to hide. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And I've had 77 years. If they want to wrap it up for me, that's their business. But they're not going to shut me up. And I'm sure they're listening to this program. And I've said it before. I'll say it again. You're not going to shut me up, guys. I'll say one more thing to my friends at the FBI and CIA who are listening, Stepan. You're on the wrong side. You're working guys just like the rest of the people are that you surveil and do all the rest of this stuff to. Why don't you get on the side of the good guys instead of supporting the crimes of the bad guys? And they don't give you a share of everything that they steal. You don't get any of that. You're used. You're an enforcer for a crime boss. And there are a lot of crime bosses around, and they use you. And whatever they pay you, it's pennies. It's pennies. How do you sleep nights? Anyway, I could keep that going for a good while.
No, you're definitely very courageous. I did not know what you just said about that abolition of the 1807 Act being snuck in. That's news to me. But what you said about the military being in the background, so true. In one of my cases at an Army base, they had about 800 soldiers in riot gear, like you said, very much in the background, several buildings over, just in case, they said, there was a riot among the journalists. Now, you know, who would ever expect a riot among, like, 20 or so journalists? But, you know, they have these contingency plans, which are just really scary. I mean, they had these fully armed military guys with rifles and everything needed to squelch a riot for 20 journalists. I mean, it's really kind of frightening. You know, this is something that I witnessed myself. They didn't use them, of course, but they were there, they were ready. So I would not be surprised at all if they had similar contingency plans in some of these other demonstrations that we're talking about.
Well, I think there are a lot of contingency plans, and just what they'll do or won't do, who can know? But you bet that they're monitoring this stuff very carefully, and it's really amazing. I've been on here we have the Arab Spring, indeed, the Arab Spring that has yet to bloom, inspired what's gone on here in America, and this stuff is also going on across Europe. It went on in Europe before the protests in America began.
Right.
But they I guess they each feed off each other and build on each other. And there's certainly powerful protests going on in countries like Greece and Italy and Spain, occasional ones in Britain and France, in Germany. I mean, literally, you go from country to country, and I can't follow all this stuff. And how much the media overseas covers it, I'm not sure. But I do read from time to time that there could be protests erupting almost anywhere. And it's the same issues all the time. You've got the social injustice issues, and instead of helping people who are really in need, they're hitting people with it when they're down with more austerity to make life even tougher for them. And in the last week, 10 days or so, the bankers of Europe fired the prime ministers of literally of Italy and Greece.
And Greece.
And replace them with bankers, unelected bankers running Italy and Greece. And, of course, they can do the same thing in any of the 17 Eurozone countries. That's a topic I've written a fair amount about, Stefan. And I'm sure I'm not done because, I mean, that is an ongoing human tragedy because of all the people who are so badly hurt. And Spain just had an election over the weekend. They threw out the so-called socialist government. It was about as socialist as I'm a super cop or something. I don't know, but they certainly are not socialists. And they gave the Conservative Party, an overwhelming victory. I don't know why anybody showed up to vote. Do they think the conservatives are going to treat them better than the socialists? Not a chance.
Well, I mean, we know from history that when times are very, very rough, as they are now for the average person, I mean, it's a matter of really survival. It's a struggle for existence that people do turn to conservatives because they're afraid. But what you said about the prime ministers in Italy and Germany being replaced, I mean, that goes completely against the democratic principles of the EU. And like you said, it just happened basically overnight. It's almost like nobody's batting an eyelash over it. But the very principles of democracy here are being threatened. I mean, you have the EU being ruled by Merkel and Sarkozy, as opposed to the way that it was, you know, originally established to give sovereignty to the various nations that comprise the EU. So yeah, I think you're right. This is a worldwide problem. There's a worldwide movement, and they're running into the same kinds of autocratic walls of power that we've been discussing for this hour.
Oh, for sure. If I remember, I think the EU has 27 countries. I may be wrong on that number, but there's a Eurozone within the EU, and that has 17 countries. And I've written so much about that. And one of the articles I got out this morning, Stefan, was about a man named Bernard Connolly. I'd never heard of him until I saw an article of all places in the New York Times. But he was a doomsayer in 1995 when he wrote a book called The Rotten Heart of Europe. and it was about the plan to establish the euro system, and he called it a harebrained idea. It was an idea doomed to fail, and they fired him. He worked for the EU, and he was either a chief consultant or a chief economist, and they fired him. They fired him for what he when his book came out. Well, he went into private business. He's a consultant, and apparently he is the expert on the eurozone fiscal monetary policy. And his advice is heavily sought by hedge fund managers, people like that, and people who use him profit greatly by the foresight that he can give them. And I wrote about him. And I managed to find a couple of quotes from his book. And I mean, he just gave the idea of countries giving up their monetary and their fiscal sovereignty to an outside power, and this was a system doomed to fail. And then you get into the zone, as you mentioned, Merkel in Germany and Sarkozy in France, the two biggest countries in the eurozone. Well, they call the shots, and the others have to go along.
Yeah.
And it's just tough. They get into trouble, and the people get harmed so badly. Well, that's just tough. So the number one rule of the eurozone, Stepan, is forget about the people.
Right.
Bankers have to be paid. That's the only thing that matters. Bankers have to be paid. Doesn't matter how much people suffer. Doesn't matter how much harm is done to economies. Just be sure bankers get paid. And that's the way these countries are being run. That's the way America is run. Be sure bankers get paid. So we're going to get a lot more austerity here. Oh, let me let you chime in. There's a big day coming up on today is the 21st. On Wednesday, America's Super Committee, talk about another lawless committee, 12 members of Congress, 6 each from the Senate, 3 from each party. Well, they're handling budget matters, and the deal is that they will come up with what they want done, and all the Congress can do is vote on what they want, up or down, no amendments.
Right.
As bad as the Congress was before now, this is the deal now on matters affecting the budget and the debt, stuff like that. Well, they couldn't agree over the weekend, and there are articles written about this. They struck out. Everybody knew they were going to strike out because the Democrats, well, I think they basically agree, but rhetorically they have to cater to their constituents to make it look like they're doing it right. So the Democrats say one thing, the Republicans say something else. They can't agree on $1.2 trillion of cuts. Anyway, we're getting near the end of the program. I want to let you wrap it up with your thoughts.
Well, as you know, what's going to happen there is instead of the mandatory cuts going into defense cuts and so forth, they're already talking about loopholes to get out of that requirement. So basically, it's going to be the same story we've been discussing. The rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to get much poorer.
And if anybody complains, they're going to end up being in the same situation as Paul. Stephen, I want to come back and do this again with you. We can plan another time to get you back.
Absolutely.
We're both on the Paul story. It's a big story because it resonates. It's much bigger than Paul. General issue that people who do the right thing can end up behind bars and just brutalized by a country that doesn't give a damn. Stephen, my great thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Stephen. And join us, of course, tomorrow. Again, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.